Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 22nd of March, 2023, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. I'm David Taylor and he's Phil Bishop. Hello, Phil.
I am indeed. Hello, David. Good morning.
How are you doing?
Yeah, all good. All good. Our regular weather report, it's grizzly and wet here in Kent.
Oh, is it? Oh, well, you know, I've got glorious sunshine here. And Tom, our producer, has got glorious sunshine up in Liverpool, so you're the odd one out.
Oh, lucky you.
Anyway, so I think we're going to talk about, well, budgets and all things connected to that. Everybody loves a budget, don't they, Phil? And we had one last week.
They do.
They do. I know that everybody loves a budget because I had, and I stopped counting at 50, emails from various companies in the construction industry and trade bodies and professional bodies and stuff like that, offering us their pearls of wisdom about what Jeremy Hunt did well and did badly. So there's plenty of comment out there, and I think we can sort of pick out a few of the highlights and maybe one or two of the lowlights as well.
Well, missed opportunity is always a cliche, yes. That comes up, isn't it?
Yes, the perennial phrase. Yeah, so quite a lot in it and quite a lot of comment about that as well. Do you want to kick that off then, Phil? Tell us basically what the gist of it all is.
Well, as I reported, I think for the construction industry, the headline news is what the Office for Budget Responsibility guesses is going to happen. It estimates, it says, with a degree of authority, but it's got a habit of being wrong, that the UK economy will shrink by 0.2% this year, but we won't actually go technically into recession, which had been expected. There won't be three consecutive quarters of negative growth, but they're going to rebound to grow for the next 3 years by 1.8%, 2.5% and 2.1%, it says. But more excitingly for construction industry, inflation is going to come down to 2.9% by the end of this year. Now, that already seems to have been slightly knocked off course by the news this morning that food inflation is 18% or something at the moment.
Yes,
food prices have bumped up. So whether the OBR is going to have to, you know, rethink that. Anyway, that is general inflation, not specifically construction inflation, which is a different thing. But the broad theme that inflation is, I don't know if it's under control or being got under control, to my mind, is the takeaway positive.
Yeah.
I suppose, I mean, a lot of the things have been talked about before, you know, money invested in low carbon energy projects, including carbon capture and storage, the setting up of this new British nuclear energy organisation, which had always been announced last time around anyway. And we've got a new series of investment zones. We promised 12 new canary wharves around the country. The idea is that less, I don't want to say deprived, but less wealthy, you know, areas of the country, if they hook up with, the local authorities hook up with the local university and they can create a tech cluster, the government will give them incentives and tax breaks and all sorts of good stuff, which elicited my favourite "what about me" comment from a Cambridgeshire estate agent who's very much involved in the whole
Cheffins,
Oxford, Cambridge, Milton Keynes arc thing. Basically said, "You don't want to give money to them Northerners. They don't know what to do with it. You should give it to us because we're much better. We've got Oxford and Cambridge. You should chuck money to people who know how to spend it properly, not them Northerners." He's clearly not on board with the whole levelling up agenda. I mean, there may be some truth in that, that you reward winners rather than losers.
I like the way that we glibly say, just team up with your local university and create a tech hub, just like that, and then we'll throw money, you know, as if you can sort of do it overnight. Mind you, I mean, there is a university in every town now, so maybe it's not as difficult as perhaps it appeared. But a rather plaintive call from Cheffins about, we've got university, you know, we can create a tech cluster.
Yeah, Oxford and Cambridge clearly need levelling up, don't they?
Yes, clearly. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there was some concern from the Construction Plant Hire Association, wasn't there, about the what was going to happen to the super deduction, which of course was introduced at the beginning of, it was the spring budget of 2021 when Rishi Sunak was Chancellor, and he announced that. And everybody said, that's great. You can claim 130% of your capital expenditure as tax on your profits. It comes to an end at the end of this month, doesn't it? So
yeah,
What's happened with that?
Well, a similar replacement scheme. It's not going to be a super deduction. It's just going to be a 100% deduction. Instead of being 130% of your investment, you'll be able to claim back 100%.
Yeah.
But it's going to run for 3 years rather than 2 years. And there's some sort of expectation that it'll continue after that in some form or another. Now, while 100% is obviously less than 130%, corporation tax is going up from 19% to 25%. Mm. So I haven't immediately been able to do the maths in my head as we're talking. But with corporation tax going up 6 points, the fact that the allowance is coming down from 130 to 100 is not as big a drop as it might otherwise be, if that makes sense to you. Because if you're paying more tax, you're getting more tax back, if you see what I mean.
Oh, okay. Yes, I can see that. All right.
So that's good news. What we still don't yet know about this is that you mentioned the Construction Plant Hire Association.
Yes.
I mean, they got very excited when Rishi Sunak announced the super deduction, as you say, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Until they suddenly realised that it didn't really apply to a lot of their members.
No, yeah.
And I've been doing some exploring on this. I asked the CPA, the Construction Plant Hire Association, whether the plant hire companies were going to be allowed to claim the new tax allowance. And it said, well, we're in talks with the Treasury. We'll let you know when we've got a firm answer on that. So they're lobbying on that and they're pushing on that, which is good. But I had an interesting chat. And it was all off the record, so I won't name the company, but you might be able to guess, to try and further my understanding of this issue. So I spoke to the head of tax at a company that is both a contractor with its own plant division, and its plant division hires plant to itself, its contracting arm, and to other contractors to the open market.
Yeah.
Now, with the super deduction, it emerged that it did not apply to companies who effectively are leasing companies, if they buy plant and just lease it, hire it on to other people, unless they also hired it with an operator. For example, a lot of tower crane companies will hire it with an operator. Dump trucks generally are not hired with an operator. So it depends what sort of plant hire you're in. So if you hire it with an operator, you can claim the allowance.
Yes.
If it's bare rental, as they often is the term, in Australia they talk about wet and dry rental.
No, I've heard that before. Operated and non-operated, I always think of. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So if you are in the business of hiring plant with an operator, you have been quids in, you will certainly continue to be quids in with this tax allowance. Now, that operator doesn't have to be an employee.
Oh.
It can be a third-party agency. Now, it seems to me that there are all sorts of, maybe not all sorts of, but at least a couple of, I don't want to say loopholes, but ways to manage your tax beneficially if you're in the plant hire business. Now, if you are traditionally hiring excavators and dump trucks without an operator, given that operator doesn't have to be employed, you can just go to your client, if you're hiring plant to Blogs the Builders, and say, here's our normal contract that says you're hiring our dump trucks. We're just going to write on the in here that 10% of this is for an operator, which you can take or you don't take, and they're not going to take the operator, but we're charging you for an operator.
Oh.
Now, if you do that, it seems to me, you're saying, well, no, it's for an operator. They just chose not to have the operator. Mm. That could lead to an interesting discussion with the tax man. You could team up with a labour-only supply company mm-hmm. who blocks the builders get their plant operators from and say, well, you're supplying the plant operators to these people. We're supplying the plant. Let's do joint invoicing, because nothing says that it has to be my employee that's going with the machine.
Oh, really?
It can be anyone's employee. As long as I'm involved in supplying the operator,
right?
It doesn't have to be my employee. So then you might be able to claim for the tax. And I don't know if people have cottoned on to this yet or if they've tried it and failed, but there's certainly a discussion to have. This is not black and white.
No, that is very interesting.
It says the tax allowance is only available if you supply the plant with an operator. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be an employee of yours. Another way around it might be for a big plant hire company that doesn't provide operators with its machines, it just does non-operated plant, bare rental, to pal up with a particular big client who perhaps used to have its a big plant hire operation and since sold it. And I think people like Keir and Balfour Beatty sold big fleets to, I can't remember who, some years ago. But if, you know, suppose they sold their fleet to Sunbelt and Sunbelt have got a supply agreement that, okay, because we've taken on your fleet, we'll supply it back. They simply say, okay, for the purpose, it wouldn't work with Sunbelt, I think they're too big. But if you're a plant only supplier and you go to a Balfour Beatty and a Keir and you say, right, so that we don't have to put up our prices to you, so you benefit, so that we can claim the tax benefit, here's the deal. You take us over for 2 years so that we become part of your company and this, on the understanding, on the contractually agreed thing, is that in 2 years' time, when this tax break ends, we'll have a management buyout. We'll go back as we were. So that might be a way around it, if anyone's prepared to do it. The only trouble with that, I figured out, you'd spend more on legal fees drawing up the contracts than you'd save in tax. So that might be too complicated.
Yes, that's probably true. And also, wouldn't you be tied into just one client for those 2 years?
Well, no, because there are plenty of the contractor I was talking to yesterday has a plant hire division which serves the parent company and other companies.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
I suppose. I'm not going to start naming names. It might indicate who I wasn't talking to, and therefore who I was. And the other thing I'm thinking of is, what is an operator?
Hmm.
Is an operator? I mean, we think of an excavator operator as the person who's got their, I was going to say, hand on the levers. It's not pushing the buttons these days, or on the joystick. But you might also be able to qualify for the tax allowance if, while you're not actually providing a person to drive and operate the machine, you are providing a person who will come round periodically and check the oil and, you know, wipe the wiper blades and do the general periodic inspections. So it's you could say, well, that's not a bare rental. That is rental plus. There's a service agreement in there.
Yes.
And
yes.
I suspect a lot of bare rental, rental companies who are leasing out non-operated plant do provide that kind of backup service.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. Yes, because I can remember that when they introduced it, they said, because I hadn't realised myself that plant hire wasn't covered by this. And yes, it was. Somebody explained it to me that if you're providing a service, that's quite different from just renting out equipment. That, as you say, that's a lease agreement, whereas the other thing is a service agreement. So if there's an element of service in there, I suppose you can say that you're providing a service.
Yes,
it's not leasing bare equipment.
It's not a complete bare rental. It's rental plus.
Yeah,
there is there's a service in there, and therefore you should be able to. And I don't know whether CPA have followed that up with the tax man, but it seems to me that if you try that on, I think you probably got a good case. Anyway, these will all be discussions that the CPA, I'm sure, are having now with the Treasury.
You've clearly been talking to an accountant, Phil. So I can tell that there's a sort of loophole that only an accountant would spot. But I mean, I'm sure there must be people out there who figured this out pretty early on, and I'd be fascinated to find out how many people have actually, you know, found a little loophole or a way around the rules, and which are beneficial to the to their client or to themselves if it's an in-house accountant.
And if anyone is prepared to share with us completely anonymously off the record, we don't need to know your name. We're just interested to know whether you've had success getting past a tax man, these sort of arrangements, that you've stuck it to the man.
Yeah.
Let David and I know, please, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be interesting, yeah.
That was one issue arising from the budget. What happens next with the tax allowances for machinery, investment, plant, and so on? So it remains to be seen. There was another aspect of this, which wasn't so much in the budget, but it was the papers that come out accompanying the budget from the Treasury, was the whole issue of points-based immigration system reforms to that.
Oh, yes.
Now, this is all to do with it, all to do with the budget. I don't quite know why it came to the Treasury. I was going to be a Home Office thing, but it came out with all the Treasury documents. The Migration Advisory Committee published its report recommending that government add, there was a whole bunch of hospitality, which is, you know, waiters and hotel workers and those sort of things, added to the list, but also a whole bunch of construction trades would added to the list of what are called the shortage occupation list, which means that you can apply the point system and you can bring in not just from the European Union, but from anywhere in the world, I believe, someone who is a member of this trade or occupation and sponsor them. And it was interesting. So the trades that have been added to the list, bricklayers and masons, roofers, roof tilers and slaters, which rules out wall tilers and floor tilers, I suppose. Carpenters and joiners, plasterers and dryliners. And then there's this general category of construction and building trades, NEC. Now, I don't quite understand it, but these have all got code numbers next to them.
Yeah.
So this is code number 5319, general building trades. Now, it seems to me if you come under general building trades, you can bring anyone in and say, they're under that category.
Yeah.
Because what the Migration Advisory Committee decided not to add on, contrary to what, I mean, Construction Leadership Council had put in their pitch and they explained cogently and coherently why we needed construction workers added to the list. The Construction Leadership Council list was exhaustive, including steel erectors, scaffolders and plant operators. But those three categories, Migration Advisory Committee said, no, you don't need that. You're not having them.
Yeah, seems a bit arbitrary to me.
The other one that's odd is the new category of trade of construction industry worker called building safety manager.
Yeah,
and this is also part of the post Grenfell Building Safety Act reforms and so on. And Migration Advisory Committee said that's not really on the list of categories. You have to assign a category to that, and then we'll include it. So they're sort of open to it, but they don't.
There wasn't a number. it didn't have a number. I think
that's the case with that. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, if you go to the Migration Advisory Committee website, there's a big report, the review of construction and hospitality shortage review. So you can see the full details of what's on the list and what's not. And this will be, the governor basically said, yep, we accept this. But the official kind of, it happens, it's coming in the summer, August or something.
Okay.
So there will be time for, if there's particular squealing about scaffolders have to be on this list, they might yet be added. The building safety managers will be added, it seems.
Oh, right,
okay.
To
sort out the paperwork. And by and large, and I noticed you wrote something similar on the international news section of the Construction Index website about how all the American Contractors Association say we want more immigration, not tear down the wall. bring in more migrant labour.
Absolutely.
And this is what the UK construction industry has been saying. We had, you know, the Construction Leadership Council have gone, great, we want more, be able to import more labour. And the Chartered Institute of Building is saying, this is great, we need to fill this, you know, the government has been listening to us, and this is great, they're reducing barriers for immigration, for the construction industry, Federation of Master Builders. Similarly, it's good to see the government's listening, blah, blah, blah. And then they all kind of quietly tag on at the end. But of course, we'll still continue to try and train some British people. Because the reason why we need migrant labour, which we do, is because we're rubbish at attracting our own young people in the industry and training them up and keeping them and paying them enough money, creating a career path where people say, yes, I'm going to go. And, you know, if I become a, whether it's a digger driver or a roofer or scaffolder or a civil engineer or an architect even, I can see that there is a good career for me. I'll be looked after, I can earn good money, and I'll have a happy life. Yeah. And for all the good work that lots of people are doing, that is clearly...
The message isn't getting across, is it?
No.
I mean, it's interesting that, you know, you and I probably get a lot of the same press releases from people cutting their training achievements, you know, that they've recruited so many apprentices in the previous year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's rather telling that this is considered to be news because, you know, it's not like dog bites man, this is man bites dog. This is so unusual to be able to attract so many people to the industry. It's worth shouting about.
Yes, it should be as mundane as we had lunch today. I mean, of course, you know, if you're in the construction industry, of course you should be taking on apprentices and training people. But you're right. People think it's, you know, oh, yeah, this is our social value.
Do you remember there was that television programme a couple of years ago now, I think, about bricklayers? I think it was on
Channel... It started again, new series.
Oh really? I know. Okay.
Just
fine.
This week.
Well, I have to catch up with it. Was it on Channel 4? Can't remember. I think it was Channel 4, wasn't it? Anyway, it doesn't matter which channel. It was on some British terrestrial channel.
Yeah, it's just started again. I haven't caught up with the new series, but yes.
But you see, I thought that was... I watched a couple of episodes of that. I thought it was giving a very clear message and a very positive message. I mean, for a start, at least two, maybe possibly three of the young brickies featured on the programme were women. And there was this...
That's two or three out of about seven. I mean, that's not right.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. They were in a minority, but not in a tiny minority. But they explained, you know, the reason I'm doing this job is that, you know, I enjoy it, and B, the money's great. You remember there's that girl saying, you know...
I want to buy a car.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I don't know whether or not it's done anything to affect the recruitment figures. But there was a clear message that this is a good career. Yeah, we'll always need bricklayers, despite all the modern methods of construction. We'll still need them. And you work hard, but you get a lot of satisfaction out of it, and it pays well. So it's a shame that we still have this problem. I mean, I think the unemployment figures are still at a record low, aren't they, in this country? We've got... only about, I don't know, was it 1 million people, 1.2 million people out of work? I can't remember.
Well, I think that's the record low of number of people looking for work. But the big story at the moment, of course, is the number of people our age, David, who could be in work, have just decided, sod it, I've had enough. I had a couple of years at home during COVID. I quite like it. I'll just settle for the smaller pension pot that I've got at the moment rather than the bigger pension pot I could do if I worked for another 5 years, and I'm jacking it in.
Yeah.
And it's not just that. This is another thing from the budget, which has nothing to do with... I say it's nothing to do with construction. I bet there are construction professionals, civil engineers and architects who are affected by this, but the story's been about surgeons and GPs, doctors, who have retired early because they've hit the limit of their pension contributions. I'm not good on the details of this, but broadly speaking, it would cost them money in their pension to carry on working.
So
they're better off stopping now. And so Jeremy Hunt has, quite rightly, it seems to me, said, right, we're going to end that nonsense. They, you know, we want these doctors to be able to keep working without losing money. And of course, the political backlash from that is, well, you're just making rich people richer. he probably is, but he's also keeping doctors in the workplace rather than on the golf course.
It doesn't make sense to pay people not to work, which is effectively what the situation is at the moment. You know, if it's not worth you going back to work because you'll be poorer, then that clearly is sending the wrong message.
So anyway, the point is, yes, there aren't that many people in historical terms looking for work, but there are an awful lot of people out there not working.
Yeah.
For one reason or another.
Yeah. And I read in a certain sort of right of centre weekly magazine, they've been crunching some government figures and worked out, well, though we've got record low unemployment at the moment, we've got something in excess of 5 million people in the UK claiming out of work benefits. Now, I haven't looked into how they actually calculate that, but it's things like job seekers allowance and incapacity benefit and I think universal credit and stuff like that. There are, you know, and the, you know, the big question is, are sort of like 2 million people claiming incapacity benefit, are they really too sick to work? You know, why have we got over 5 million people in this country who not working claiming benefits? So,
David, you've got to stop reading those magazines. Have you seen I, Daniel Blake?
Have I seen what?
I, Daniel Blake. It's a Ken Loach film.
No, I haven't.
It's, at least I think it's that. That is certainly worth watching. It might be another Ken Loach film. But the problem is, as soon as a typically right of centre government, but there have been Labour ministers who have been very keen to crack down on shirkers and slackers as well. But as soon as this becomes the focus of government policy, you end up having people in very difficult situations suddenly having their benefits removed and cut.
Yeah.
Because you know, some person who's filling in the forms decides that they don't qualify for the box for whatever reason without having time to gain a proper understanding of their situation and need.
Yeah.
And it can get quite ugly for governments when they start, you know, drawing up their, was it Peter Lilly had a little list of people who he was going to get, including, you know, unmarried mothers and, yeah, no, it all, gets, it all gets rather ugly.
I think Suella Braverman's the person to tackle that one, actually. She's quite good at that sort of thing. Right, we're going to move on to a different topic, or have we got more to say about the budget?
Well, no, there's more. This was actually not mentioned in the budget. I think Jeremy Hunt said to the Transport Secretary, Mark Harper, you're going to have to take the flak for this one.
Mm-hmm.
So the Transport Secretary put out a statement, put out a press release, and this press release, so a week before the budget, was headlined, Transport Secretary sets out record investment plans for transport network. I say, look at it, fantastic! Yeah, rub their hands, there's going to be lots of new money for roads and rail and buses and trams. And so you read this story about this government announcement, record investment plans for transport network, and it says that basically, yeah, we're spending more this year than last year, mm-hmm. but unfortunately, with construction inflation of whatever it is, 15-20% over the past couple of years, we're going to have to kick things into the long grass. So we're going to, for the time being, we're not going to run HS2 into Euston. We're going to stop it in West London, Old Oak Common, and then you're going to have to get a... Some people have been rather cruelly saying you have to get a replacement bus service, which is not true, of course, because we've now got Crossrail in the nick of time. So I think you pick up Crossrail at Old Oak Common if you want to actually get into central London or anywhere else. And various big road jobs have also been kicked from road investment strategy period 2 into period 3, i.e. they're supposed to start before 2025, and now they're going to start sometime before 2030. And these include Bam Nuttall's £320 million A27 Arundel Bypass Project, £335 Princess Way Scheme in Liverpool, which is very controversial actually, but improves access to the port of Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a Keir job being bumped forward several years. Lower Thames Crossing is going to be bumped from period 3 to period 4. So instead of starting sometime before 2030, it's now going to start sometime after 2030. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Stonehenge is on there, that's in the long grass already. So there's an awful lot of big projects we say, yeah. And I think I've said this before on this podcast today. You say, well, are they going to axe these projects? No. Governments never axe projects if they can
they
help
just
it. They simply
them.
Keep pushing them forward.
Yeah.
But we've seen it before in the public, any public sector job. I mean, Crossrail itself actually started about 20 years after it was supposed to, when it was called the Chelsea Hackney Line. The Jubilee Line extension was about 20 years after it. The Channel Tunnel started about 100 years after it first started. These things are expensive things. Governments haven't got magic money trees and all of that. And so things do get pushed back. There's nothing new about that. And it was just so inevitable.
Yeah.
But here it is. It's happened.
So, basically what Mark Harper was saying, we're going to spend more, but you're going to get less.
Yes.
Yeah, so, exactly. I think, maybe next year we'll find out that HS2 is going to start somewhere like Bicester and it's going to end in Warwick or something like that. Still spending the same amount of money on it, but just trimming off the ends a little bit.
But the irony is, of all these, as many, many commentators have observed, is that these projects are only going to be more expensive the longer you leave them. They're not going to get cheaper. They're only going to get more expensive. And particularly the Euston project is going to be ridiculously more expensive by dragging it out and slowing it down.
Yeah. But that's going to be somebody else's problem, isn't it? Because let's face it, we're not going to have a Tory government in a couple of years' time unless something miraculous happens, and probably Labour's going to have to pick up that one and tell us how they're going to deliver value for money.
Well, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if some of these things will be the Tories' problems, but not this time around.
It's going to drag on that long.
That long, some of these things will. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
Lower Thames Crossing, for example, that will run and run.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. No, nice bit of spin doctoring, though, on that story. Yeah, record investment.
The sheer gore. I mean, there's absolutely, it was purely a statement about projects were being pushed back, delayed because we can't afford them, because they were too expensive. And they're not too expensive because of the wretched construction industry can't build things, or they've done something wrong. It's purely because of global economic inflation.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think that's all I've got from the budget issues. Have you got anything else?
I don't know. I think that was probably it. There was a lot more.
I suppose the other thing we should say is a lot of people were hoping that there'd be a new grandchild of Green Deal or some other sort of encouraging people to giving people incentives to fit ground source heat pumps rather than gas boilers and get more insulation and double glazing and all of that. And that didn't really get a mention.
No.
We've had an announcement this week for a new round of local authority and housing association grants for decarbonising the social and council housing sector.
Yeah.
But that was always on the cards. That was always going to come through the pipeline. It wasn't particularly surprising news to throw the bunting out for.
No, indeed. So, right, shall we move on to a fresh topic then, Phil? Do you want to talk about Mr. Gove?
Yeah, let's do this one briefly. I mean, this is all part of the post-Grenfell Tower fire business of discovery that lots and lots of tower blocks have got the same or similar cladding that Grenfell Tower had, which makes them unsafe. And during all the inspections, other fire safety issues came to light. And I don't think there'll be anyone listening to this will not be familiar with the 5 years that have been spent toing and froing over who and how is going to pay and do the work to fix all these tall buildings. The latest state of it is that not so long ago, Michael Gove, the Housing Secretary of State, said that anyone who'd put up or refurbished tall buildings, this is over, 18 metres?
Yeah.
In the past 30 years, as I recall, I mean, all sorts are happening. All housing developers are having to pay a new tax that will fund this program. But these the companies concerned, the developers concerned, house builders concerned, have been made to sign a contract saying we'll fix it, and we'll fix it by certain time, and we'll do this, that, and the other. And he gave a deadline of March the 13th.
The
last week, the beginning of last week, is the deadline for that to sign it. And 11 firms had not signed it. Most had. 39 developers signed the contract by the deadline, saying, yep, we're the good guys. We'll do whatever it is you're going to make us do. And it's costing them lots of money. Just this morning, Vistry Group wrote off best part of 100 million for the cost of fixing up homes that it's been, or tower blocks that it's been associated with. And that's sort of a fairly typical sum for a lot of these, the larger companies. But 11 have not signed by the deadline. rapidly, three more did sign. Telford Homes, London Square and Ballymore, who had missed the deadline, but were still left with a few baddies. Now, I might be able to take them by events.
Yeah.
But the current baddies, name and shame them, Abbey Developments, Avant Homes, which should get a few hackles rising, because that's, as I believe, that's Jeff Fairbairn.
That's right, yes. Yes, he took them over, didn't he?
Persimmon, yeah. 300 million, whatever his bonus was.
I think he settled for about 75 million in the end.
But so, Avant needs some good publicity and decided not to take the opportunity.
Yeah.
Danderer, don't know much about them. Emerson Group, which is Jones Homes. Galliard Homes, mm-hmm. Who I think Michael Gove has been particularly, I think he mentioned them, the House of Commons there in particular, who seems to be a particular enemy of his. Lendlease.
Mm-hmm.
Ryden Homes, which is another trigger point, because part of the Ryden Group was contractor on the Grenfell Tower, which put the dodgy cladding on the Grenfell Tower. I've read some of the Ryden Homes saying, hang on a minute, we only do about one house a year. We don't do two tall buildings. I think they're querying why they're even on this list.
Right.
So there might be something there, but the very fact of them being on this list, no one's going to be sympathetic to Ryden for a long time to come yet, true. Purely because of their involvement in Grenfell. And then our friend Inland Homes are on this list. And we talked about Inland Homes last time.
Yeah.
So in all kinds of stew. News from Inland Homes this week is that they've managed to appoint two non-executive directors so as not to be in breach of stock market rules. Inland Homes is on the AIM, alternative investment mm-hmm. market, the London Stock Exchange. And it is a requirement that you have so many shareholder representative independent directors on the board, and the entire Inland Home board quit earlier this month.
Yeah.
And this is after the chief executive had only been in the job for 6 weeks. He quit in January. So people have just been jumping ship left, right and centre. We still don't entirely know what the problem is that they've uncovered there that's made them all so kind of like, oh, I don't want to be involved in this. but the company has said that when it does eventually get around to reporting its results for the year to September 22, it's going to be a £91 million loss. So we know the finances are screwed. They've got this new board, I say new board, a non-exec chairman and a non-exec director, but not the person they thought they flagged up that they were going to bring back Stephen Wicks, the founder.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Who retired last year. But he's not come back. Instead, they've got some other bloke I've never heard of, an accountancy type, and someone from Trevor Sawyer, previous managing director of Barrett Homes Southern Counties, has joined as a non-executive director. So he's clearly got knowledge and experience of the house building business. So he should be able to bring something to bear there. So the point is, Inland Homes have got a lot on their plate.
I was going to say, maybe they hadn't even noticed that they hadn't signed this contract.
I think the letters are probably still sitting on the doormat or the in-tray of someone who doesn't work there anymore.
Put it in the pending file.
Yes. So that could be the issue there.
Yeah. But I mean, it's interesting though to wonder why these organisations hadn't signed up to Gove's contract, because it's embarrassing if you haven't, because of course the fallout from the Grenfell Tower fire has really sort of thrown things up in the air, and anything that smacks of being negligent or greedy or incompetent, it's terribly bad news and really, really bad publicity. You'd think that these people would say, I mean, they're gonna have to in the end. They're gonna be held to account. I mean, because Gove says, you know, your ability to trade in the market will be compromised if you don't.
But he and other housing ministers have been saying for about 3 years now, you'd bloody better do it, or something really bad will happen. I'll be really cross. And when he gave them the deadline of 13, 14th of March, whatever it was, he said, sign it by then or you're, you know, red card, you're out of it. And then when they hadn't signed, he said, look, let me be really clear. We are coming after you. If you don't sign, you'll not be able to operate freely in the market. Now, he's still not actually done anything. He's still just threatening. So maybe they're just calling his bluff.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I suppose, are these the companies which have the greatest burden of remediation, you know, sort of in their in-tray, that it's going to really blow a hole in their finances if they have to sign this?
I don't think these are companies with the biggest number of towers to do.
No.
I think, you know, Lendlease and Galliard may have a bunch, but the smaller companies won't have many, but they've got less finances, so it might still have the same impact to their finances. I don't know the details of that, David. It's a good question. I think in some cases it might just be they've got, and maybe the eight who still haven't signed have all got are all represented by the same law firm, and it's some particular shark of a lawyer, some, you know, Sue Grab It and Run type. Who are saying,
don't lose your nerve, lads, just sit tight. Yeah.
So it might be just some bastard lawyer standing behind them.
Could be. Well, I mean, so what's next? I mean, the deadline's gone. And is it time for Mr. Gove to start using the big stick that he's been waving? And if so, how would he do it? I mean, is he going to stop them building homes?
Could do. I mean, I suppose he could direct local authorities not to give them planning permission. He could, I don't know how much social housing these people do or how much public sector contracting they do. I think Lendlease is in bed with some local authorities on regeneration schemes, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I don't know. There's obviously going to be a mix of sort of classic sort of, you know, two-storey housing developments and sort of houses of multiple occupancy, sort of, you know, flats and apartments. But I suppose it depends on the proportion of each. I mean, Avant, for example, I would assume, although I don't know, but I think probably the majority of their work is probably in traditional housing, detached, semi-detached, terraced housing, rather than...
Yes, everything I see, all the press releases I get through from them are all northern town, suburban housing estate-y type things.
As you say, somebody like Galliard Homes and Lendlease, I think, probably are more involved with the high-rise developments.
Urban, yeah.
I'm just guessing at that, but that's the impression I get. Emerson Homes, I don't know anything about. Abbey Developments, don't really know much about them, and Dara, I'd never heard of. So, don't know, really. But maybe if they think, well, we'll just get out of the high-rise sector, and, you know, if they say that we can't build high-rise, then so be it.
So be it, yeah.
Now, I think there's something you wanted to end on. There was quite talking about house builders, was it?
Talking about house builders, one of the good guys... talking of house builders, one of the good guys who has signed up, and I mentioned them earlier, is Vistry Group, which is somebody who may remember them as Bovis Homes, but they've not just got the legacy of Bovis Homes, but also, which is actually not particularly a big legacy in this case, it's more Linden Partnerships, which used to be part of Galliford Try.
Yeah.
Bovis and Linden merged to form Vistry a couple of years ago, was it? Last year, Vistry bought Countryside Partnerships, which is another one that's done a lot of these social housing, local authority, tower blocky type things and refurbs and whatever. So you've got Linden, Countryside and Bovis. All those liabilities are all there in Vistry. But that's not why Vistry in the news today. Vistry, interesting, published their results and their 13% revenue growth, which you can't attribute to the Countryside acquisition because that didn't happen until the end of November. Might be a little bit, but not really. Mm-hmm. So they've had a good year. Pre-tax profit was down 22% to around 250 million. But that was after exceptionals of 154 million. So this is all, it's 97 million on fire safety provisions and 57 million on costs related to the Countryside acquisition.
Okay.
So excluding these one-off costs, pre-tax profit up 21%. All going well at Vistry. But what I find more interesting is the guy that they've just put on their board as a non-executive director, someone who I'd never heard of until last year, Jeff Ubben, UBBEN, don't know how you pronounce his name, he's from California. Mm-hmm. He's founder of Inclusive Capital Partners, a San Francisco hedge fund. And he came into UK construction industry prominence last year when, as a shareholder of Countryside Partnerships, which was then stock market listed, he launched a hostile takeover bid to take it private. And there was a big argument, Countryside wasn't doing what it needed to be doing, and he could make it better, and da-di-da-di-da-di. In amongst all of this, Countryside found a white knight in Vistry, and Vistry took over Countryside for $1.25 billion last year, instead of Jeff Ubben and Inclusive Capital Partners. Now, this still means that, as part of the takeover deal, Inclusive Capital Partners, or INCAP as their name for short, still was left with a substantial stake in Vistry, having been a Countryside takeover.
Yeah.
At 5.9% stake in Vistry, making it second biggest shareholder. And this guy is now being put on the board of Vistry. Not as a shareholder representative, it's just because they say he's a smart cookie who will be able to help us do great things. He knows how to add value, do stuff. And at the time when Vistry took over Countryside, he said, Ubben said he was happy with that solution, that Vistry is a good, well-run company, he's got a lot of time for Greg Fitzgerald, the CEO there, and that was all cool. It wasn't going to think about that. That's great. So he's friends with Vistry. But what I find interesting about the particular small print, and this is clearly stated in the stock market report, because this guy's got a reputation as an activist investor who gets onto boards, builds up a stake, and makes, as other people might see it, makes trouble, as he would see it. I'm sure he's trying to make things better.
He's a disruptor. He's a disruptor, Phil. We know we like disruptors, don't we?
No, they're disruptive. You like disruptors.
No.
Yes.
You're supposed to like disruptors these days.
Yes. Disrupting is supposed to be a good thing.
Yeah.
But
not this sort of disruption.
But others, I'm sure the Countryside board previously saw him as a troublemaker.
Yeah.
But so perhaps because of this reputation, unfairly or fairly earned, who's to say, he has made certain undertakings to the board. He's on the Vistry board on the condition that he doesn't circulate any statements to shareholders. He doesn't go sending out messages to shareholders saying, "Oh, this bloody Greg Fitzgerald is getting it all wrong, and we need to do something and vote this way and vote that." He's not allowed to requisition any general shareholder meetings. He's not even allowed to propose any resolutions at shareholder meetings. He's not to try and move against any other directors to get them thrown out. And any vote that comes up on the board, he and his shareholding he doesn't actually represent them on the board, but any shares that he's got control of, they have to vote in the line with the majority of the board.
Oh, right. Okay.
So he cannot be a dissenting voice. He can be a dissenting voice, but when it comes to, putting your hand up or putting your paper in the ballot box or whatever, he's got to toe the line.
Hmm.
And maybe this is not uncommon, but I've not heard of these sort of constraints put on before. And I think it's a fun and fascinating story.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wonder if he's sort of seething secretly that, he's been gagged or...
No. He'll think, I'm not a troublemaker. They'll see sense. They'll do as I say.
Yeah.
They'll just know that I'm right. Everyone will agree with me. And you don't get to be that rich and successful without having powers of charms, persuasion, influence. Sure. Not that it worked at Countryside, so maybe it won't work at this year either, but interesting.
Well, yes, all the shenanigans of boardroom politics, it's something I'm not familiar with, I have to confess.
No, me neither. We've talked for long enough, David, do you think?
I think we have.
Fulfilled our contractual obligation to witter on for an hour or so?
I think so.
Half an hour is supposed to.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think we've done a good stint, Phil.
Good stuff. Right, we'll be back again in 2 weeks' time then, by which time it will be April.
Yeah.
Are you planning any April Fools next week? Do you do that sort of thing? You don't do that sort of thing.
No, I don't do that sort of thing, because I work on my own, Phil. I'd be playing jokes on myself. And you know, maybe the joke is on me.
You can make yourself an apple pie bed in the morning, and by the time you go to bed at night, you've forgotten all about
it. I'd have forgotten all about it, yeah.
Fool myself. Okay, well, once again, everyone, thank you for listening. I'd like to repeat that request. I would love to hear if you've managed to find a way to claim tax deductions for your plant investment, even though you are not sending an employed operator with it, because you found some way around it. Do let us know. And anything else that you think we should be talking about, do get in touch. podcast@constructionindex.co.uk. But for another sesh, it's goodbye from me, Phil Bishop, and from him, David Taylor.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.